Okay, I want to thank the organizers of this meeting for inviting me. It's always great to work here. And my talk is on asymptotics. If you're an expert in asymptotics, then this talk will probably be boring because I want to give an introduction into exponential asymptotics and also how it's maybe connected with some oscillatory phenomena. Many of the results are at least 5 years old, or maybe even older. Before I give you an outline, let me at least give you a little bit of flavor. The asymptotic expansion that I'm dealing with in here, that is a large variable. I have divergent series. I assume that they are special type. You have ray 1, which means that the coefficients grow like factorial over m power, which happens in many problems. So this is just a divergent series. The Stokes phenomena will play a very important role. That's where exponentially small terms are being switched on. And if you then continue, so if you just move in the complex Z plane, and if you continue after that, you move to the next anti-Stokes line, you get oscillations, and that's the oscillatory part of my talk. And I mean, a simple example is just the graph of the area function. If Z goes to plus infinity, you have just a simple exponential behavior. If you go to minus infinity, you have oscillations, which means that you have two exponentials. And Stokes took this problem, and he was reasoned, what happens if you go from plus infinity to minus infinity, but you stay in the neighborhood of infinity? Somewhere an exponential has to be switched on. And that's how he discovered the Stokes phenomenon. I will deal with this in a moment with another example, not the area function, but a slightly simpler one even. And the final thing that will show in my talk is the following. Many of these problems have a property that's called resurgence. So the ans are the coefficients in my asymptotic expansion. They grow like n factorial over power. These divergent series, they switch on other series with coefficients. And in many problems, if you look at the late terms, so a of s, but for s going to infinity, then it has an asymptotic expansion where the coefficients are the coefficients that also appear there. This will show up in a moment, yeah?
Since you have an is n factorial modulus by n lambda to the power n, why couldn't you take lambda together with z in the first sum, an by z to power n?
Well, you could, yes. You can always rescale it and make that one. But not if you have many of them. If you have one of them, yes, but if you study a second order problem, you have two expansions, then yes, one of them you can make one, but not the other one then at the same time.
There we have lambda z.
Lambda z, yes. Exactly, yes, that's right. Okay, quick outline. I first will mention the Stokes phenomena, and just to show you the smoothing for it. Then I will show you, as a very gentle introduction, local hyperasymptotics for integrals. That's just to show you that in asymptotics we have divergent series, and you can truncate them and do a re-expansion. And here I want to give you a very simple example, but it's local. It's only valid in small regions. Then I will do global hyperasymptotics, which is valid in large sectors and in has many nice properties. And finally, I will mention a little bit about work in progress. But tomorrow there's a talk by Chris Howells, and he will do much more on this, on plans for the future. So let me start with divergent series. If you have a series that's of the form, let's say n factorial divided by z to the power n, then it's divergent. If you then look at the terms in such an expansion, then the first few decrease in magnitude if z is large, but at some point you reach a minimum term, and then they increase in magnitude. So there is a minimum term. I should go one back. So this is, for example, taking z is equal to 10. And in this case, the 10th term is the smallest. If you take z is equal to 15, then the 15th term is the smallest. And if you take z is 20, the 20th term is the smallest. And here I have a logarithmic scale. So this is exponential growth here. So first of all, you see that the optimal term is approximately the z term. And second, you see that the smallest remainder if you really stop at that point, is exponentially small, it's e to the power minus z. Which is a bit strange because it's smaller than any fixed term in this expansion. You can only achieve it by taking optimal number of terms constantly. Okay, Stokes phenomenon. This is extremely simple differential equation, first order, linear. Okay, it's inhomogeneous. The asymptotic expansion is given here. It's the divergent series. And the only freedom that you have is a constant, adding a constant. Exponential multiplies that divergent series. So if z is positive, and the real part of z is positive, the constant is invisible. Each term in the divergent series is bigger than a constant. If the real part of z is negative, then the constant is visible. Now what happens if you start in this, oops, my battery is going, I think. If you start in this sector here and you travel to this sector, and Stokes discovered that the constant changes. In fact, the Dieri function shows that it happens, if you look at the graph of the Dieri function. But it happens in a region where you can't see it. Now this is all based on the work of Stokes, what I'm telling you here. Stokes already did this. He took this asymptotic expansion, this very simple factorial over power. He knew that if you do optimal truncation, that the error is exponentially small. And if you look at that, how small is it in this case? In fact, this is order one everywhere. It's z minus the absolute value of z. So although in the asymptotic expansion itself, the constant isn't visible, if you look at the remainder, the constant is bigger than the remainder if you use optimal truncation. And this is exactly what Stokes did in one of his papers. And then he realized that there's only one place where the change can happen, and that is exactly at the worst place, it's in the middle. There the constant is, there this behavior is roughly of order one. And how, what happens there exactly? Is it really an inhomogeneous a jump there? And the answer is no. In fact, Stokes was already doing the following calculation himself. Although he didn't have Maple or so to plot it. If you take your function, let's take C is 0 in the top quadrant. It's a unique solution. I can compute it numerically. I can subtract this exponential times the polynomial there in 1 over z. That's a nice function that doesn't have any interesting properties, no jumps or whatever. If you look at the difference and you just look at it as a function of the phase, z is e to the power I theta times the absolute value of z. As a function, if I start with z is equal to the phase of z is pi, then it's 0, that's by construction, it remains 0, the constant, but then near the positive real axis, it switches smoothly from 0 to 2 pi.
Sorry, actually, W, Z, comma, naught. The naught there is C equals naught, is it?
Yes, in this quadrant here. And that's what you see here that, as well. And in fact, if you read Stokes' paper carefully, he was doing this calculation. He computed this difference at a few points himself. But we had to wait much longer for somebody actually showing that that's an error function. That was Michael Berry in 1989. And then a big part of exponential asymptotics started with that observation. So this error function that you can use for the smoothing of the Stokes phenomena gives you a local smoothing. It's correct, that expression there, near the Stokes line. It's not correct everywhere. If you want to do exponential asymptotics, it's better to use hyperterminums. I will introduce them in a moment, but these are the simplest functions that have in Stokes phenomena, the exponential integrals, or maybe you call them incomplete gamma functions. So Stokes' famous quote is given up here, where he describes that you enter in this region here with a certain constant, the constant isn't visible here, and if you exit it, the constant has changed.
Oh, sorry, are you saying that the previous is exactly this, or that this
this minus 2 pi I, or which?
No, I mean, on the previous slide, sorry, the C of theta, which is...
Oh, no, this is just, the C is by assumption already constant, so... But if you look at the remainder here, it's actually a smooth remainder. So the switch from one to the other one is a smooth function. It must be a smooth function because it's an analytic differential equation.
But given exactly by the error function in the limit as Z tends
to... No, that's a, they are correction terms.
Okay, you use the term constant change.
Yes, exactly. But it's, that's the magic of asymptotics. So in a way, this has to do with truncating an asymptotic expansion and then trying to do something better, optimally. And I want to give you a very simple example. It's just this integral here, which has many representations. You can either call it an exponential integral, you can call it an incomplete gamma function, or maybe some of you prefer a confluent hypergeometric function. It's all of those, just that function. I want to do asymptotics, and these slides, they originate from this bit at least, from a course that I gave to PhD students in Europe, and so it's just an elementary exercise. What's the first step that you do? If z is large and you plot the dominant part of the integrand, which is e to the power minus zt, it's this function here. There was 12 years ago a meeting here on exponential asymptotics, and there was one French mathematician there who told me the following. Whenever we draw the exponential function, we always draw it wrong for our students, because we always draw it like it goes smoothly to zero. Whereas if you really plot it, you can see it goes to zero extremely fast, and then it is zero. I mean, you can't see the difference. And that just shows you that the main contributions come from the origin. So what would you do to get an asymptotic expansion? You just expand the other bit of the integrand around the origin, you plug it in, and you get your asymptotic expansion. So nothing special there. And great thing is that you get an exact representation for the remainder, and you can just estimate this remainder by throwing away this bit that's not important, and you get factorial over power. So the remainder is smaller than the first neglected term, and that's ideal. And you can also study the remainder as a function of n. What is the best that we can do if we look at this remainder not as a function of z, but as a function of n? And then you see that it's the best you can take is n is roughly z. Z is positive in this part of my talk. And if you do that, then the error that you make is exponentially small. E to the power minus z, and even a z to the power minus a half extra. So that's the best that you can do with Poincaré asymptotic expansion, with that simple series. Can we do better? Now you have to look at this minimal remainder. But now there are two places where you have a large parameter. N is roughly z. So this function is actually the one that you have to plot. And if you plot that function, it has changed its shape. It's not, its maximum is not at zero anymore. In the meantime, it's at one. And if this would be your starting point, what would you do? You would not expand the other part of the integrand, the 1 over 1 plus t at zero. No, you would expand it at t is 1. And that's all you have to do to get an improvement. So I expand 1 over 1 plus t at 1, plug it in, the integral representation, and I get my, running out, okay. I get my asymptotic expansion, plus the new terms, the ones that involving pn, plus the remainder, again, an exact representation for the remainder. The pn's, the new terms, they are not factorial over power anymore. They're slightly more complicated, but not much, because this is just 1 minus t to the power n. So if you expand that, then you get just again gamma functions divided by z powers. But if you want to calculate them, it's better to just use this very simple recurrence relation, and you can compute them numerically in a very stable manner. So that's a re-expansion. So what's the picture of it? We had the red dots were the original series. We truncated optimally, and then we do the re-expansion. These are the green dots. And in asymptotics, usually the next term is roughly the size of the error that you make. So what you can see is this is roughly twice as good than what you had originally. It's just a very simple trick in this case to get a better approximation. and studying. Oh yeah, and one observation. One thing you can see again is re-expansion is also divergent. The original error, best error that you could get, is e to the power minus z. Now what you get is e to the power minus 1.9 times z. So that's almost twice as good. And if you're a mathematician, and if you can do something like this once, you can do it twice. So, I mean, the next remainder that you want, the next expansion that you want to do is expand 1 over 1 plus t at 3, and what you get is e to the power minus 3.59 times z. So that's 3.5 times as many the correct digits. And you hardly have to do anything extra. But unfortunately, this only works with very special or nice integrals, and maybe you can use it also for differential equation. The main drawback from this expansion, in a way, is that it's only valid in a very small sector, and it can't incorporate the Stokes phenomena. So although numerically it looks very nice and all the results are very easy, it's in fact only valid in a very boring part of the complex plane. I mean, also the reason why you can replace asymptotic expansions by continued fractions, and continued fractions are maybe better to compute these functions numerically than asymptotics, but continued fractions are not valid where a Stokes phenomenon happens. And what you will see in a moment, hyperasymptotic expansions can be valid there. Okay, this part of my talk is in a paper that we wrote in the 90s with Frank Oliver. It's on second order ODEs. I want to show you what global hyperasymptotics can do. So this is a second order ODE. There are two formal solutions to this e to the power lambda 1. Oops, still not working. E to the power lambda 1 and e to the power lambda 2 times z. I assume for simplicity that the difference is 1. That's the scaling that you also want to propose previously. In that case, the optimal number of terms is roughly, again, the absolute value of z. That doesn't change. This one is recessive at the positive real axis, and this one is dominant, and vice versa here. If you start with this solution, with this asymptotic expansion here, then it's valid. So this is the complex z plane, then it's valid over here. Here, this solution is maximally dominant over that solution, so a Stokes phenomenon happens. You switch on a constant times this solution, and that means that you can't cross the next anti-Stokes line because this solution would start dominating. So in this sector, or in this half plane, the asymptotic expansion is actually e to the power lambda 2 times z times this series plus another constant times the other solution. Now, what will global hyperasymptotics do for this expansion? I truncate this one optimally, the first one, I re-expand. This re-expansion has several nice properties. I will explain the details later on, but at least I will tell you then what this F1 is. It's just the first hyperterminant.
So actually, the little f and little g, the assumptions about them are...
Oh, I assume that I have an essential singularity at infinity of rank 1. In fact, it's not even important that this originates from the differential equation. You can just think of any problem where you have two asymptotic expansions that can only switch on each other. So it could also come from an integral with two saddles, or something like that.
What does it mean that you expand now?
I'll tell you what this is. So I truncate it optimally, and I add something extra. First of all, you will see in a moment that in the old sector, these terms are smaller again than the previous one, and the remainder is better. But more is happening here. Previously, we should go back. Oops, sorry. Back, I think. We had a barrier here because of the Stokes phenomenon. The new one is valid in a bigger sector. Again, half a Riemann sheet in this direction, and another half a Riemann sheet in the opposite direction. So this extra expansion here incorporates the Stokes phenomenon itself. That's great. If you do a re-expansion, you could the coefficients in that could be very complicated. They're not. They're exactly the coefficients of the other solution. That's the resurgence part of this. So everything in here is known. You don't have to compute anything new, except one minor thing, but that will play an important role, this constant. So Stokes multiplier, or other people call it connection coefficients between solutions. For many special functions, these are known, but in general, there is no nice expression for these things. And in fact, that's the hardest problem of all. And it just relates the solutions of one Riemann sheaf to the one on the next. But everything else is known. I'll tell you in a moment what this function is. First, let me show you what the terms do in an expansion like that. So we take this original divergent series, we truncate it, and we re-expand. That are the green terms. And if you can do it once, you can do it twice. And these are the second level hyperterminants. The coefficients are the original coefficients. Again, and the only thing extra new is an extra Stokes multiplier that you have to evaluate. And in fact, I mean, one thing that you can see here is that the number of terms halves with each level, and then, of course, at some point it stops. But in fact, you can do better if I look at the first two expressions and optimize them as a function of n and m at the same time, then you will see that the surprising result is that you should actually take twice the optimal number of terms in the first expansion and then n terms in the second expansion. And then you exactly double your precision. The first one was of the order e to the power minus z. This is of the order e to the power minus 2z. I'm not going to tell you afterwards that you should use this to do incredible, to get extremely good numerical approximations. I mean, it will give you that, but that's not the main purpose of these things. Because if you go to the next level, you get e to the power minus 3 times z. I mean, who wants 30 digits? Hardly anyone, but you can achieve it. And also, here I took z as roughly 10 or 20. This will also work when z is 2 or 3 or so, and then you get also a much better approximation. So the great news is that you get it with almost everywhere the same coefficients. You don't have to compute anything new. Okay, I'll give you now a general flavor. Sometimes it's better to look at an nth order equation instead of a second order equation, just to get to see what happens in general. So assume you have a problem where you get n asymptotic expansions, formal asymptotic expansions that can switch each other on. So you could think of a linear differential equation, nth order. You can think of an integral with n saddles. You can think of maybe difference equations or nonlinear differential equations. I assume that all these asymptotic expansions are of algebraic class 1. So they're all factorial divided by power. And the only thing they can switch on is each other. So if you start your divergence of your hyperasymptotic expansion, you truncate your first one. And here I assume that n is 4. I have a fourth order equation. So that means that at the first level, it will switch on 3 solutions. The Stokes lines might be in complete different directions. They're not the same. The next level, again, each of them switches on the 3 other ones. So you get a tree structure. It doesn't look pretty, but everything in this is computable. And the hyperterminants are written down here, and I will now give the definition. The first one is this horrible integral. It looks horrible, but it's just I integrate along a special direction to infinity, which is where I want the Stokes phenomenon to happen. And the rest of this is just a simple exponential integral. I mean, these are known functions. There's nothing new here. So an exponential integral, or maybe you call it an incomplete gamma function. Easy to compute everywhere in the complex plane to arbitrary precision.
Why do you have this infinity symbol up there?
Because that's infinity in that direction. So I integrate along a straight line in that direction to infinity. But I just specify it because then that's the direction where the Stokes phenomenon will happen. I could also just integrate from here, from 0 to plus infinity, but then I would have all these directions in here, and everything becomes messier. So you can just rotate it if you want to. The other ones are just generalizations of this. So this is an n-fold integral. They're just loosely connected. They're easy to estimate. If you ignore the bottom bit, then these are just simple gamma functions, product of gamma functions. And when we started our exponential asymptotics matrix 12 years ago here at the Newton Institute, people were doing and creating papers on hyperasymptotics, but nobody knew how to compute these functions. At the end, we knew how to do it. And yeah, the trick was a convergent expansion in terms of confluent hypergeometric functions here, a sum over k. So these are very easy to compute. These are coefficients. The first one is just a simple gamma function, and the other ones have a recurrence relation. So you can compute the next by an expansion in the previous one. So you can compute them. It will take your computer some time, but they can do it. Okay, I want to skip this. This is an explanation why you have all the nice symmetry, but that's all the Borel transform. So if anyone has questions, I could explain that later on. I just want to show you this expansion. So what you get in hyperasymptotics, and in fact, this you can write down immediately when you know the first n expansions, so just the first n formal solutions of your problem, you can write this down immediately. The two bits, the black bits and red bits. All the black bits you know. You get them for free at the moment that you write down your n solutions of your problem. The red bits you don't know. So here's a problem. I want to approximate the function on the left-hand side, but I still have to compute these Stokes multipliers. And there's no magic formula for the Stokes multipliers that you can use in general. They're just coefficients. They don't appear anywhere else. You just have to compute them. However, there is a trick that you can use. Now, this here, this is by a coefficient in my original asymptotic expansion. And this is probably the most complicated way that you can write a coefficient. I write it as the difference of two remainders. I mean, that sounds ridiculous. But what is this remainder? This bit here, so everything except the top line, is a remainder. So I have a nice expansion for the remainder. I can plug it in here, and I can plug it in there. And if I do that, I get the next slide. I get an asymptotic expansion for my coefficients with exactly the same tree structure than on the previous slide, this one here. And if you decide which position you want to achieve here, then you take exactly the same number of terms here. The difference is that in this case, you know the left-hand side. You can compute these coefficients. So the only unknowns in this problem are these Stokes multipliers. And this is just a simple equation. You can just use some simple linear algebra and compute them numerically. And as far as I'm aware, this is by far the best method to compute these Stokes multipliers. All methods are based on the growth of coefficients, as far as I'm aware. So in a way, this result here that you see here might be even more important than the whole hyperasymptotics itself. The first bit, if you look at just this column here, it's not so special. It's just factorial, and it's large, divided by a power. So that's what you expect. But all of these are divergent, and you can re-expand them over and over again if you want to. So this you can also just obtain via the Darboux method used on the Borel transform of the whole problem. Okay, let me finish this bit with an example. This is a fourth order differential equation. I want to compute W1. One, lambda 1 is I, so W1 is e to the power iz at that point. So there are four asymptotic expansions in this case. You have to compute all those Stokes multipliers. You can do that with the previous slide and up to any position. And then plug it into these formulas. The details are not important, but you take 33 terms of the original expansion. You take a certain number of terms of these three first re-expansions, and again, more here. The coefficients are given here as well. So that's your original divergent expansion and three re-expansions, and each of these is re-expanded again. But here, of some of them, you only take two terms. And the Stokes multiplying these two terms, you only need up to a few digits precision. Whereas the Stokes multiplying that series here, you must know it up to many digits precision. And if you do that, you can get these ridiculous precisions. So the first originalized Poincaré expansion would give you 6 correct digits. The first level would give you 13. The next level would give you 19 correct digits. And all of this always with the same amount of knowledge. You don't have to compute anything new. You use the same coefficients over and over. So let me summarize this part. In hyperasymptotics, you can get much better numerical approximations with the same amount of information, resurgent. You keep using the same coefficient over and over. You get larger sectors of validity. With each level, you increase it by a Riemann sheet because you incorporate more and more Stokes phenomena. It's an efficient way, or maybe the only good way, to compute Stokes multipliers to any precision. This is maybe even more important, especially if you do look at nonlinear differential equations. Normally, if you haven't did the divergent series, there's not a unique solution to that. In linear problems, by making the sector of validity big enough, you can define a unique solution. In nonlinear problems, you can't do that anymore. If you look on papers on Penelope asymptotics, people have big problems defining solutions uniquely via the asymptotic expansions. If you use hyperasymptotic expansions, they are defined uniquely. And this is a nice byproduct of the whole hyperasymptotics. This is a result by Bill Boyd in 1992, I think. We'll be doing these improved asymptotic expansions, so we have to deal with remainders. And one of the results was, for the first time, a sharp and rigorous error bound for the Stirling approximation of the gamma function. Everyone who knows asymptotics knows this asymptotic expansion. But there were no error bounds for that one. There are error bounds for the logarithm of the gamma function, but not for the gamma function. And he has nice, sharp error bounds for that. And in nonlinear problems, on the boundary of sectors of validity, you know, you usually encounter singularities, poles, or whatever. And with this hyperasymptotic expansion, you get some information on them. Okay, so this is just about hyperasymptotics. Now I want to say, when I first I'll show you some literature. This list is definitely not complete. The first two papers, or three papers, were on special cases by Mike Berry and Frank Oliver. Then papers appeared on integrals, so lots of them. The final one is here on multiple integrals. Merely, there were also papers on second-order linear ODEs and new hyperasymptotics for them. Non-linear ODEs, there was a paper by Kostin and Kruskal in 1998, and I did recently the Riccati and the Penelope. And difference equations, there are some papers on it as well. It's a bit harder, difference equations. The higher order linear ODEs, the main results that I presented are all in this 1998 paper of mine. And there are also, in the meantime, at least these, there might be more books, but I know at least these books mention exponential asymptotics. And there's some Scottish connection here, it seems. Lots of these people here live or are Scottish. Okay. I want to finish with kind of some work in progress or mention some new things. So far, the Stokes phenomena that I mentioned, I only had one parameter, a large parameter, and the Stokes phenomena happened when I switched the phase of the large parameter. If you have more than one parameter, so here is an integral with an extra parameter, bulk phase x, there could be many parameters, then a Stokes phenomena can also happen by just letting this extra parameter vary its value. So in that case, you can just take your large parameter z real and change x in value. And what will happen then? And so in this X space, you get special places where for X, where a Stokes phenomena happens, and that's what we call Stokes lines or Stokes curves. And I'd like to finish with just introducing this problem. I think Chris will mention it in more details tomorrow. It's a simple linear PDE. It was constructed by John Chapman from Oxford. Because for one reason, that it has one special phenomenon that you will see in a moment. So the solution in the asymptotic expansion here into the powers of epsilon is given here. But it was nice because it also has an exact solution in terms of integrals. The integrals are easier than PDEs. And this integral has three contributions to its asymptotics. So z is still going to infinity. X and t are two free variables here. There are three objects that contribute to the asymptotics. There's an endpoint, there's a pole, and there's a saddle point. And we were looking for a problem where you had three different types of asymptotic expansions. And okay, oscillations here, you see oscillations. You start at for the boundary data for x is 0 somewhere, and you move forward, at some point the Stokes phenomenon happens and you get oscillatory behavior. Okay, let me show it in more detail here. T, let's call it time. If you start at t is 0, you have your initial data for your PDE. In this little triangle here, only the endpoint contributes to the asymptotic expansion. The three black curves are Stokes curves. So if you cross one of them, then a Stokes phenomena happens. So the three objects that contribute to this integral were the endpoint, the pole, and the saddle point. If you travel from here to here, then the saddle point is switched on by the pole. If you then go upwards, the endpoint switches on the saddle point, there the saddle point switches on the pole. If you travel from here to here, then the endpoint switches on the pole. Here, a nice exercise, if you travel from here to here, the saddle point will switch on the pole, but the saddle point isn't active, so nothing happens. But that's not special. If you continue traveling, then the endpoint switches on the saddle point, and now you get a contradiction. This line in the middle should be a Stokes line. So if I travel up there from right to left or the other way around, either the pole should be switched on or switched off. But they're active on both sides. And that's a contradiction. I mean, when I travel from here to here, the pole is switched on, and up there it isn't. But that's a Stokes phenomenon. It should happen there. Now, what has happened? In the meantime, we crossed something that we call a new Stokes curve, a higher order Stokes curve, and there the Stokes phenomenon is switched off. So let me first translate that into hyperasymptotics. So I started with asymptotic expansion. Then I showed you that you can re-expand and you get a level 1 expansion. Now the Stokes phenomenon is objects on level 1 switch on something on level 0. That's a normal Stokes phenomenon. You go from here to here. But now you have all your extra levels. If you're on level 2, you could switch on something on level 1 or switch off at something at level 1. At the moment that you cross over this new curve here, a higher order Stokes phenomenon happens. The Stokes phenomenon is being switched off. So on one side of this curve, the endpoint can switch on the pole, but up here it can't, because it's switched off. And for that you need three asymptotic behaviors for this to happen. But I'm not going to do in any further details. But if you would not know about that, and if you would start traveling like that, you would get the wrong asymptotics in here. You would give you the wrong oscillations in there. Tomorrow I think Chris will show you more pictures on this problem and other problems. Okay, thank you for your attention.